identified most of the cards, and after a small increase, all the subjects identified them all. For the normal cards, these identifications were usually correct, but the anomalous cards were almost always identified, without apparent hesitation or puzzlement, as normal. The black four of hearts might, for example, be identified as the four of either spades or hearts. Without any awareness of trouble, it was immediately fitted to one of the conceptual categories prepared by prior experience. One would not even like to say that the subjects had seen something different from what they identified. With a further increase of exposure to the anomalous cards, subjects did begin to hesitate and to display awareness of anomaly. Exposed, for example, to the red six of spades, some would say, "That's the six of spades, but there's something wrong with it. The black has a red border." Further increase of exposure resulted in still more hesitation and confusion until finally, and sometimes quite suddenly, most subjects would produce the correct identification without hesitation. Moreover, after doing this with two or three of the anomalous cards, they would have little further difficulty with the others. A few subjects, however, were never able to make the requisite adjustment of their categories. Even at 40 times the average exposure required to recognize normal cards for what they were, more than 10% of the anomalous cards were not correctly identified. And the subjects who then failed often experienced acute personal distress. One of them exclaimed, "I can't make the suit out, whatever it is. It didn't even look like a card that time. I don't know what color it is now, or whether it's a spade or a heart. I'm not even sure now what a spade looks like. My God!" Myth and literature constantly represent the parched kingdom, the society victimized most frequently by drought, which is the absence of water, concretely, and the water of life or spirit, symbolically, brought on by the over-prolonged dominance of the once great ruling idea. This idea, in the narrative, and frequently in actuality, is the king, the ancestral spirit, representative of his people, made tyrannical by age, pride, or unbearable disappointment, withering under the influence of some willfully misunderstood, malevolent, advising force. The development of such an unpleasant and dangerous situation calls, of course, for the entrance of the hero, the lost son of the true king, raised in secrecy by alternative parents, the rightful ruler of the kingdom whose authority was undermined or who was supposedly killed during vulnerable youth, the proper heir to the throne who had been journeying in far-off lands and was presumed dead. The hero overturns the tyrant and regains his proper place. The gods, pleased by the reestablishment of proper order, allow the rain once more to fall, or stop it from falling in dangerous excess. In a story of this type, the creative aspect of the unknown, nature, is locked away, metaphorically, by the totalitarian opinion of the current culture. Such a state of affairs might be represented, for example, by the sleeping princess in the kingdom brought to a standstill, or by some alternative variant of the existence of the treasure hard to attain. Paralyzed by patriarchal despotism, or frequently by fear of the terrible mother, the kingdom remains stagnant, while the princess, nature in her benevolent guise, waits for the kiss of the hero to wake. Her awakened and revitalized beauty subsequently reanimates her people. Rituals of the death and renewal of the king act out this transformation of cultural adaptation long before the concept of rebirth can be rendered abstractly comprehensible. Northrop Frye states, "The hypothetical ritual studied in Fraser's Golden Bough may be vulnerable enough in various anthropological contexts, but as a mythical structure, it is as solid as the pyramids. Here, a king regarded as divine is put to death at the height of his powers for fear that his physical weakening will bring a corresponding impotence to the fertility of the land he rules. When sacrificed, the divine king is immediately replaced by a successor, and his body is then eaten and his blood drunk in a ritual ceremony. We have to make a rather violent effort of visualization to see that there are now two bodies of the divine king, one incarnate in the successor, the other concealed in the bellies of his worshippers. The latter causes the society to become, through eating and drinking the same person, integrated into a single body, which is both their own and his. The extensive and universal corpus of dying and resurrecting god myths acted in sacrificial ritual dramatized two notions. The first is that the actual ideas slash patterns of behavior governing adaptation must die and be reborn to ensure constant update of the techniques of survival. The second, more fundamental, is that the hero, the active agent of adaptation, must eternally upset the protective structure of tradition and enter into sacrificial union with the re-emergent unknown. Cosmological phenomena themselves act out, are utilized as descriptive tools for, more accurately, this eternal drama. The sun god, born in the east, dies in the west, and passes into the underworld of night, into the lair of the dragon of chaos. Nightly, the sun hero battles the terrible forces of chaos, cuts himself out of the belly of the beast, and is reborn, triumphant, in the morning. The master of the strange in its natural form is the hero in his technological guise, more particularly, say, than in his role as social revolutionary. Marduk, who faced Tiamat in single combat, is a very focused representative of man's mastery over nature. The pattern of action signified by this god, that is, courageous and creative approach in the face of uncertainty, was regarded unconsciously by the Mesopotamians as necessary, as stated previously, to the creation of ingenious things from the conflict with Tiamat. The hero fashions defenses out of nature to use against nature. This idea, which underlies man's cultural adaptation, manifests itself naturally in the human psyche. Spontaneous Fantasy, manifested August 10, 1997, by my daughter Michaela, age 5 years, 8 months, while playing Prince and Princess with Julian, her 3-year-old brother. "Dad, if we killed a dragon, we could use his skin as armor, couldn't we? Wouldn't that be a good idea?" The hero uses the positive aspect of the Great Mother as protection from her negative counterpart. In this manner, the natural disaster is kept at bay, or, better yet, transformed from a crisis into an opportunity. The Stranger. Arrival of the stranger, concretely presented in mythology, constitutes a threat to the stability of the kingdom, metaphorically indistinguishable from that posed by environmental transformation. The stable meaning of experiential events, constrained by the hierarchical structure of group identity, is easily disrupted by the presence of the other, who practically poses a concrete threat to the stability of the present dominant structure, and who more abstractly, as his actions contain his moral tradition, exists as the literal embodiment of challenges to the a priori assumptions guiding belief. The stranger does not act in the manner expected. His inherent unpredictability renders him indistinguishable from the unknown as such and easily identified with the force constantly working to undermine order. From a within-group perspective, so to speak, such identification is not purely arbitrary either, as the mere existence of the successful stranger poses serious threat to the perceived utility of the general culture. and, therefore, to its ability to inhibit existential terror and provide determinate meaning to action. When the members of one isolated group come into contact with the members of another, the stage is therefore set for trouble. Each culture, each group, evolved to protect its individual members from the unknown, from the abysmal forces of the great and terrible mother, from unbearable affect itself. Each evolved to structure social relationships and render them predictable, to provide a goal and the means to attain it. All cultures provide their constituent individuals with particular modes of being in the face of terror and uncertainty. All cultures are stable, integrated, hierarchically arranged structures predicated upon assumptions held as absolute. But the particular natures of these assumptions differ, at least at the more comprehensible and conscious levels of analysis. Every culture represents an idiosyncratic paradigm, a pattern of behaving in the face of the unknown, and the paradigm cannot be shifted. Its basic axioms cannot be modified without dramatic consequences, without dissolution, metaphoric death, prior to potential reconstruction. Every society provides protection from the unknown. The unknown itself is a dangerous thing, full of unpredictability and threat. Chaotic social relationships, destructured dominance hierarchies, create severe anxiety and dramatically heighten the potential for interpersonal conflict. Furthermore, the dissolution of culturally determined goals renders individual life identified with those goals meaningless and unrewarding in intrinsic essence. It is neither reasonable nor possible to simply abandon a particular culture, which is a pattern of general adaptation, just because someone else comes along who does things a different way, whose actions are predicated on different assumptions. It is no simple matter to rebuild social relationships in the wake of new ideas. It is no straightforward process, furthermore, to give up a goal, a central unifying and motivating idea. Identification of an individual with a group means that individual psychological stability is staked on maintenance of group welfare. If the group founders suddenly as a consequence of external circumstance or internal strife, the individual is laid bare to the world. His social context disappears. His reason for being vanishes. He is swallowed up by the unbearable unknown, and he cannot easily survive. Nietzsche states, "In an age of disintegration that mixes races indiscriminately, human beings have in their bodies the heritage of multiple origins, that is, opposite, and often not merely opposite, drives and value standards that fight each other and rarely permit each other any rest. Such human beings of late cultures and refracted lights will on the average be weaker human beings. Their most profound desire is that the war they are should come to an end." Of course, the unstated conclusion to Nietzsche's observation is that the war, typifying the person of mixed race, mixed culture in more modern terminology, is the affectively unpleasant precursor to the state of mind characterizing the more thoroughly integrated individual who has won the war. This victor, who has organized the currently warring diverse cultural standpoints into a hierarchy integrated once more, will be stronger than his unicultural predecessor, as his behavior and values will be the consequence of the more diverse and broader ranging union of heretofore separate cultures. It is reasonable to presuppose that it was the unconscious consideration of the potentially positive outcome of such mixing that led Nietzsche to the revelation of the dawning future Superman. It is not the mere existence of various previously separated presuppositions in a single psyche that constitutes the post-contact victory, however. This means that the simplistic promotion of cultural diversity as panacea is likely to produce enemy, nihilism, and conservative backlash. It is the molding of these diverse beliefs into a single hierarchy that is preconditioned for the peaceful admixture of all. This molding can only be accomplished by war conducted between paradoxical elements within the post-contact individual psyche. Such a war is so difficult, so emotionally upsetting and cognitively challenging, that murder of the anomalous other in the morally acceptable guise of traditional war frequently seems a comforting alternative. Fundamental threats can be posed very easily between groups of people. Most concretely, foreign behaviors are threatening, unpredictable in particular, terrifying in general, because essential beliefs, challenging beliefs, are most convincingly expressed through actions. He became to us a reproof of our thoughts. The very sight of him is a burden to us, because his manner of life is unlike that of others, and his ways are strange. Wisdom 2:14-15. A foreign man, a stranger, is threatening because he is not firmly fixed within a social hierarchy and may therefore behave unpredictably, with unpredictable consequences for the social hierarchy. Signals of safety and threat vary, or may vary, between members of different groups. Unpredictable means potentially dangerous. More abstractly, what the stranger believes specifically threatens the integrated structure of historically determined belief in general. This does not pose a problem when his foreign actions or ideas do not produce fundamental conflict, do not threaten key beliefs. When basic concepts are threatened, however, the unbearable, terrible unknown once again rises up, and once firm ground begins to give way. The strange idea. Increasing ability to abstract makes previous learning established through non-abstract means increasingly modifiable and increasingly vulnerable. In a way, this is the whole point of abstraction and the very capacity to learn. Words, deceptively simple and harmless, are sufficient to create disruption and conflict because Homo sapiens can verbalize his beliefs. It could be said, therefore, with sufficient rationale, that a new idea is an abstract stranger, or, by the same logic, a natural disaster. It is for this reason that the pen is mightier than the sword. The process of increased abstraction allows for increasing self-understanding, self-consciousness, at least in potential, and for the prediction of the behavior of others, which is a capacity integrally linked to the development of self-consciousness. How would I behave in a situation like that? In addition, abstraction eases communication of morality, instruction in how to behave, by making it unnecessary to wait around to watch until something important actually happens. The use of drama, for example, which is the representation of behavior in behavior and image, allows us to watch the interplay of issues of mortal consequence without the actors or the observers actually suffering that consequence. The capacity to abstract has not come without price, however. The incautious, imaginative, and potentially resentful can easily use their gift of socially constructed intelligence to undermine moral principles that took eons to generate and that exist for valid but invisible reasons. Such invisible principles can be subjected to facile criticism by the historically ignorant once they take imagistic, written, or spoken form. The consequence of this criticism is the undermining of necessary faith, and the consequent dissolution of interpersonal predictability, dysregulation of emotion, and generation of enmity, aggression, and ideological gullibility as the naked psyche strives to clothe itself once again. The danger of such criticism can be more particularly appreciated when the effect of what might be described as cascade is considered. We can change our behaviors because we change how we think, although this is not as simple as is generally considered. We can change how we think facilely and without regard for the consequences, partly because we do not understand why we think what we think, because all the facts that govern our behavior are not at our conscious disposal, and because the effects of that change are often not immediately apparent. The fact that changes in tradition have unintended and often dangerous side effects accounts for the conservatism of most human cultures. Cascade means that threat to the perceived validity of any presupposition at any level threatens all levels simultaneously. This means that the casual criticism of a given explicit presupposition can come over time to undermine the unconscious imagistic and procedural personality and the emotional stability that accompanies it. Words have a power that belie their ease of use. Figure 49, the fragmentary representation of procedure and custom in image and word, provides a schematic representation of the organization of behavior and schemas of value in memory. Customs, that is, predictable and stable patterns of behavior, emerge and are stored procedurally as a consequence of constant social interaction over time and as a result of the exchange of emotional information that characterizes that interaction. You modify me, I modify you. We both modify others, and so on, in a cycle that involves thousands of individuals over thousands of years. Most of this information is a more or less permanent part of the social network, is part of the structure of society, but can become represented in part or whole in image, and then more explicitly in verbal code. The imagistic representation of the morality constituting a given society is likely to be incomplete, as the complexity of the patterns emerging consequential to the totality of social interaction exceeds current representational capacity. The semantic representations perched above the images are likely to be even more incomplete. This means that the verbal systems utilized in abstract thinking, for example, contain only part of the puzzle at best. They have only partial information regarding the structure of the whole. So, while some of the rules governing behavior have become completely explicit and understood, others will remain partially implicit and poorly understood. Some of these partially implicit rules are likely to exist for completely implicit and therefore completely invisible reasons. It is rules like this on the ragged edge of comprehension that are likely to attract ill-informed but nonetheless potentially devastating criticism. Abstract verbal intelligence may therefore pick holes in the absurd mythological structure that supports it, without understanding either that it is supported or that the act of undermining is existentially, mortally dangerous. It is easy to criticize the notion of the immortal soul, for example, and the traditional forms of morality that tend to accompany such a belief, without realizing that there is much more to the idea than meets the eye. Cascade means that threat to the perceived validity of any presupposition at any level, generally verbally mediated, now becomes threat to that presupposition and to everything that rests on it. The socially mediated capacity to abstract, to reason and represent in behavior, imagination, and word means that an ill-chosen action, fantasy, or thought may have devastating consequences. This is true, in particular, of the word. One well-chosen phrase can change everything, from each according to his ability. The word, in a particular context, one established by behavior and episodic representation, has a polysemous significance. It excludes more, constrains more than it appears to, and means more than it contains, considered as an isolated or decontextualized element. It has this capacity in part because it is capable of referring to phenomena outside its domain in order to make itself understood. This is use of metaphor. The word brings to mind events and actions sequenced in a particular manner. It is the imaginary presentation of these events and actions that contains much of the meaning. The words merely act as cues for retrieval. The information retrieved is not necessarily yet semantic. It may still remain embodied in episodic memory and procedure. The polysemous quality of the meaningful word, which implies something for imagistic representation and for the structuring of behavior, is what makes it potent and dangerous. An entire behavioral hierarchy can be undermined by a well-chosen creative phrase, because the phrase brings with it, as integral part of an integrated whole, moral presuppositions of entirely different and perhaps logically or at least apparently contrary nature. There is an apocryphal story cited by Stephen Hawking about a cosmologist lecturing to a rural audience of laypeople in the late 1800s. He describes the basic structure of the solar system, laying emphasis on the fact that the Earth floats unsupported in space, endlessly circling the sun. After the lecture, an old woman approaches the podium and says, "That was a very interesting story, young man. Of course, it is completely absurd."
"Absurd, madam?" the lecturer inquired.
"Whatever do you mean?" "It is a well-known fact," replied the old woman, "that the earth rests on the back of a giant turtle."
"Is that so, ma'am?
What, then, does the turtle rest on?"
"Don't play games with me, young man," responded the matron. "It's turtles all the way down."
The author and thinker Douglas Hofstadter presented a similar idea in a fictional discussion between Achilles, the Greek hero, and a tortoise of Zeno's Paradox fame.
Tortoise.
For purposes of illustration, let me suggest that you consider the simpler statement, 29 is prime. Now, in fact, this statement really means that 2 times 2 is not 29, and 5 times 6 is not 29, and so forth, doesn't it?
Achilles.
It must, I suppose.
Tortoise.
But you are perfectly happy to collect all such facts together and attach them in a bundle to the number 29, saying merely, 29 is prime.
Achilles.
Yes.
Tortoise.
And the number of facts involved is actually infinite, isn't it? After all, such facts as 4,444 times 3,333 is not 29 are all part of it, aren't they?
Achilles.
Strictly speaking, I suppose so. But you and I both know that you can't produce 29 by multiplying two numbers which are both bigger than 29. So, in reality, saying 29 is prime is only summarizing a finite number of facts about multiplication.
Tortoise.
You can put it that way if you want, but think of this. The fact that two numbers which are bigger than 29 can't have a product equal to 29 involves the entire structure of the number system. In that sense, that fact in itself is a summary of an infinite number of facts. You can't get away from the fact, Achilles, that when you say 29 is prime, you are actually stating an infinite number of things.
Achilles.
Maybe so, but it feels like just one fact to me.
Tortoise.
That's because an infinitude of facts are contained in your prior knowledge. They are embedded implicitly in the way you visualize things. You don't see an explicit infinity because it is captured implicitly inside the images you manipulate. The psychologist of narrative Jerome Bruner's comments on triggers are equally apropos here. He gives the following sentences as examples. Trigger.
John saw/didn't see the chimera.
Presupposition.
There exists a chimera.
Trigger.
John realized/didn't realize he was broke.
Presupposition.
John was broke.
Trigger.
John managed/didn't manage to open the door.
Presupposition.
John tried to open the door. There exists a virtually infinite number of presuppositions for every trigger.
Bruner states,
obviously, you cannot press a reader or a listener to make endless interpretations of your obscure remarks. But you can go a surprisingly long way, provided only that you start with something approximating what Joseph Campbell called a mythologically instructed community. The transmission of what is generally regarded as spiritual wisdom is in fact able to take, to be reduced to narrative form, precisely because the word, in the context of the story, which is description of episodic representation of events and behaviors, has this deceptively simple yet infinitely meaningful triggering property. Another parable put he forth unto them, saying, the kingdom of heaven is like to a grain of mustard seed, which a man took and sowed in his field, which indeed is the least of all seeds. But when it is grown, it is the greatest among herbs, and becometh a tree, so that the birds of the air come and lodge in the branches thereof. Another parable spake he unto them. The kingdom of heaven is like unto leaven, which a woman took and hid in 3 measures of meal, till the whole was leavened. All these things spake Jesus unto the multitude in parables, and without a parable spake he not to them, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophet, saying, I will open my mouth in parables. I will utter things which have been kept secret from the foundation of the world. Matthew 13:31-35. It is not merely the story which is saturated with meaning. It is imagination, behavior, and the practical consequences of imagination and behavior as well. The individual ideas, particular fantasies, and personal actions of individuals presuppose the culture from which they are derived. The word, in meaningful context, is meaningful precisely because it provides information relevant to episodic representation per se, and because it has relevance which may not be consciously comprehensible or declarable for behavior. Likewise, the behavior and fantasies of self and other, in context, are predicated upon culturally determined values and beliefs, and could be said, in a manner of speaking, to contain them. It is for this reason that Carl Jung could claim, with regard to the fantasies of a modern dreamer, he is, in fact, an unconscious exponent of an autonomous psychic development, just like the medieval alchemist or the classical Neoplatonist. Hence, one could say, cum grano salis, that history could be constructed just as easily from one's own unconscious as from the actual texts. Even the more concrete implement or tool, like the word, is not an artifact separable from the culture in which it is produced. It is failure to comprehend this fact that dooms many well-meaning foreign aid projects, and, no less, the foreigners to which such aid is granted. Even something as simple as the shovel or hoe presupposes the existence of a culture that has granted the individual dominion over nature, so that the individual has the right to make the Great Mother subservient to the claims of man. This notion constitutes the central idea of complexly civilized patriarchal culture and emerges into consciousness against competing claims with the greatest of difficulty. As Mircea Eliade states, an American Indian prophet, Smahala, of the tribe of Umatilla, refused to till the soil. It is a sin, he said, to wound or cut to tear or scratch our common mother by working at agriculture. And he added, "You ask me to dig in the earth? Am I to take a knife and plunge it into the breast of my mother? But then, when I die, she will not gather me again into her bosom. You tell me to dig up and take away the stones? Must I mutilate her flesh so as to get at her bones? Then I can never again enter into her body and be born again. You ask me to cut the grass and the corn and sell them to get rich like the white men. But how dare I crop the hair of my mother?" Every society shares a moral viewpoint, which is essentially an identity composed of unquestioned fidelity to a particular conception of reality, what is and what should be, and of agreement upon the nature of those behaviors that may reasonably be manifested. All the individuals in a particular nation agree fundamentally about the nature of the unbearable present, the ideal future, and the means to transform one into the other. Every individual plays out that conceptualization in terms of his or her own actions more or less successfully. More successfully, or at least more easily, when nothing unintended arises to make the act of questioning necessary. Less successfully when the moral action does not produce the proper consequence. Any assumption can be challenged. The most fundamental expectation of my fantasies, whatever they might be, is that my assumptions are valid. Mismatch between what I desired and what actually occurred constitutes evidence that one or more of my assumptions are invalid, but not necessarily information about which one or at what level. The outcome of such a mismatch is application of other assumption-predicated patterns of action and associated expectations associated with gathering of new information through active exploration. The further down the hierarchy of assumption that mismatch occurs, the more stressful the occurrence, the more fear is disinhibited, the more motivation for denial, the more necessity for exploration. The more necessary reprogramming of behavioral assumption and matching sensory expectation. A truly unexpected event sequence upsets the implicit assumptions upon which the original particular fantasy was predicated. And not only that fantasy, but innumerable presently implicit others equally dependent for their existence upon those violated presuppositions. The inevitable consequence of such violation is the breakdown of expectation and consequent generation of fear and hope, followed by exploration, the attempt to adapt to the new environment, to behave appropriately, to fulfill motivational demands under new conditions, and to map new conditions. This consequence requires the paralysis of the old model. Reversion of otherwise stably maintained affects to competition and chaos, and exploration-guided reconstruction of order. The more basic the level, the more that assumption is shared by virtually every conceivable fantasy. The more basic the level undermined, the more anxiety and depression, and other motivation, particularly and non-evidently hope, released from containment. The more behavioral adaptation cast into disrepute, the more motivation for denial, deceit, fascistic readaptation, degeneration, and despair. The more wish for redemption. The undermining and reconstruction of more basic levels is, as we have seen, a revolutionary act, even in the scientific domain. The normal scientist works within the constraints of great models. The revolutionary changes the models. The normal scientist accepts the current game as valid and tries to extend its relevant domain. The revolutionary scientist, who alters the rules of the game themselves, is playing a different game with different and dangerous rules from a within-the-game perspective. Thomas Kuhn states, "The transition from a paradigm in crisis to a new one from which a new tradition of normal science can emerge is far from a cumulative process, one achieved by an articulation or extension of the old paradigm. Rather, it is a reconstruction of the field from new fundamentals, a reconstruction that changes some of the field's most elementary theoretical generalizations, as well as many of its paradigm methods and applications. During the transition period, there will be a large but never complete overlap between the problems that can be solved by the old and the new paradigm. But there will also be a decisive difference in the modes of solution. When the transition is complete, the profession will have changed its view of the field, its methods, and its goals. The normal scientist is often antithetical to his more extreme, more creative-slash-destructive counterpart, like the good citizen opposes the heretic, in part because alteration of the rules changes the motivational significance of previously valued action and thought, often, apparently, reducing it to zero, which means that the revolutionary can completely destroy the significance of the career, past, present, and future, of the dedicated plotter. In part, because restructuring of the rules temporarily returns everything to a state of anxiety-provoking chaos. Kuhn states, "A paradigm is prerequisite to perception itself. What a man sees depends both upon what he looks at and also upon what his previous visual conceptual experience has taught him to see. In the absence of such training, there can only be, in William James's phrase, a bloomin' buzzin' confusion." That bloomin' buzzin' confusion, the great dragon of chaos, is not affectively neutral. In fact, its affective significance, threat and promise, is perhaps all that can be experienced of it before it has been categorized. Sometimes new information means mere lateral adjustment of behavior, the modification of approach within a domain still defined by the familiar goal. Sometimes, however, the unknown emerges in a manner that demands a qualitative adjustment in adaptive strategy, the reevaluation of past, present, and future, and acceptance of the suffering and confusion this necessarily entails. Kuhn comments on the effect and affect of emergent and persistent unknown in the domain of science. The pattern he describes characterizes all cognitive revolutions, including those that take place in the universe of normal morality. As Kuhn states, "When an anomaly comes to seem more than just another puzzle of normal science, the transition to crisis and to extraordinary science has begun. The anomaly itself now comes to be more generally recognized as such by the profession. More and more attention is devoted to it by more and more of the field's most eminent men. If it still continues to resist, as it usually does not, many of them may come to view its resolution as the subject matter of their discipline. For them, the field will no longer look quite the same as it had earlier. Part of its different appearance results simply from the new fixation point of scientific scrutiny. An even more important source of change is the divergent nature of the numerous partial solutions that concerted attention to the problem has made available. The early attacks upon the resistant problem will have followed the paradigm rules quite closely. But with continuing resistance, more and more of the attacks upon it will have involved some minor or not so minor articulation of the paradigm, no two of them quite alike, each partially successful, but none sufficiently so to be accepted as paradigm by the group. Through this proliferation of divergent articulations, more and more frequently they will come to be described as ad hoc adjustments, the rules of normal science become increasingly blurred. Though there still is a paradigm, few practitioners prove to be entirely agreed about what it is. Even formerly standard solutions of solved problems are called in question. When acute, This situation is sometimes recognized by the scientists involved.
Copernicus complained that in his day, astronomers were so inconsistent in these astronomical investigations that they cannot even explain or observe the constant length of the seasonal year. With them, he continued, it is as though an artist were to gather the hands, feet, head, and other members for his images from diverse models, each part excellently drawn, but not related to a single body. And since they in no way match each other, the result would be monster rather than man. Einstein, restricted by current usage to less florid language, wrote only, it was as if the ground had been pulled out from under one, with no firm foundation to be seen anywhere upon which one could have built. And Wolfgang Pauli, in the months before Heisenberg's paper on matrix mechanics pointed the way to a new quantum theory, wrote to a friend, at the moment, physics is again terribly confused. In any case, it is too difficult for me, and I wish I had been a movie comedian or something of the sort and had never heard of physics. That testimony is particularly impressive if contrasted with Pauli's words less than 5 months later. Heisenberg's type of mechanics has again given me hope and joy in life. To be sure, it does not supply the solution to the riddle, but I believe it is again possible to march forward. Now, Kuhn drew a qualitative distinction between the normal and revolutionary modes of operation. No such qualitative differences exist, although exemplars of the two types, drawn from the extreme poles of the process of knowledge production, can easily be brought to mind. The distinction is more along the lines of transformation of what the group wants to transform versus transformation of what the group would like to remain stable, with the revolutionary changing more than might presently be desired, for the maintenance of the extant social hierarchy, for example. The transformation of what the group wants to transform is a form of bounded revolution, as we have discussed previously. Optimally bounded revolutions produce positive affect. Revolutions that upset the desired bounds, which are what Kuhn's revolutionary scientist produces, evoke fear and denial and aggression as defense mechanisms. The revolutionary produces involuntary alteration in the articles of faith of the normal individual. It is this capacity that makes him revolutionary and necessary, and feared and despised. It may be more generally said that processes of discovery which upset large-scale space-time maps produce disruption of affect on an equivalent scale, and that it is such large-scale disruption that we entitle revolution. Mythologically structured social and individual presumptions, articles of faith, provide the environment in which a given culture-specific adaptive pattern retains its conditional validity. This pre-rational mythic environment is analogous in structure to the physical or natural environment itself, as the structure adapted to the environment rapidly becomes a constituent element of the environment itself with the same essential characteristics. Or, to say it somewhat differently, everything contained outside the wall, defining presently considered space, is environment, even though much of it is actually the consequence of historical or even individual activity. Disruption of the pre-rational mythic environment is just as catastrophic as disruption of the physical or natural environment. The two disruptions may not really be distinguishable in the final analysis. This means essentially that to give serious consideration to another's viewpoint means to risk exposure to indeterminate uncertainty, to risk a rise in existential anxiety, pain, and depression, to experience temporally indeterminate affective, imagistic, and cognitive chaos. It is much more likely, in consequence, that a foreign viewpoint will appear evil or will come to be defined as such, especially during times rendered unstable, unbearably novel, for additional alternative reasons.
Once such definition occurs, application of aggression designed to obliterate the source of threat appears morally justified, even required by duty. The alternative or foreign viewpoint is in fact reasonably considered evil, although this consideration is dangerously one-sided when viewed in terms of its potential destructive capacity from within the strict confines of the historically determined social-psychological adaptive structure. It is only within the domain of meta-morality, which is the morality designed to update moral rules, that the strange may be tolerated or even welcomed. The group, in its external social and intrapsychic incarnations, is the current expression of a form of acting and thinking that has been given particular content over the course of thousands of years. These particular contents, patterns of behavior and their representations, were established initially by individuals who faced the unknown and prevailed, who were able to do or think something that no one had been able to do or think before. In this manner, heroic individuals create new assumptions and formulate new values. The integration of these assumptions and values into the group, through the competitive process that begins with imitation and ends with verbal abstraction, increases the permanent behavioral and abstract logical repertoire of the individuals that form that group. The sum total of such behavioral patterns, and second and third order descriptions thereof, shared within the social group, constitutes that group. Groups are predicated upon a collective, historically determined structure of abstractly represented behavioral patterns and consequences thereof, which tends toward internal consistency and stability over time. Internalization of this behavioral pattern and representations thereof protects the individuals who compose the group against fear of their own experience. The group is the culturally determined hierarchical structure of behavior and abstracted conceptualization thereof, which inhibits fear of novelty, the terrible mother, source of all nightmares. The group is the historical structure that humanity has erected between the individual and the unknown. The group, in its beneficial guise, serves to protect the individuals who compose it from threat and the unknown. The social establishment of how to behave when presented with a given situation inhibits the paralyzing fear that situation would otherwise instinctively induce. The group is also simultaneously the concrete historical expression of Homo sapiens' unique heroic thesis, as stated previously, that the nature of experience can be altered for the better by voluntary alteration of action and thought. This central thesis is expressed in the myth of the way. Loss of previously extant paradise initiates the redemptive activity, history. Restoration of paradise, in the course or as a consequence of proper behavior, is its goal. This general pattern appears characteristic of all civilizations, every philosophy, every ideology, all religions. The general idea that change may bring improvement, upon which all voluntary change is predicated, is in itself based in the ideal upon the assumption, on the necessary fiction, that through historical process perfection might be attained. This myth, even in its earliest ritual incarnation, therefore provides the basis for the idea of progress itself. The group, history incarnate, is the embodiment of a specific mode of being designed to attain perfection and contains the concrete expression of the goal of a people. It is the objective and subjective realization of the mode by which they improve their tragic condition. History not only protects people from the unknown, it provides them with rules for achieving what they desire most and, therefore, for expressing the essentially undeclarable meaning of their lives. Human moral knowledge progresses as procedural knowledge expands its domain, as episodic memory encodes ever more accurately the patterns that characterize that knowledge, as the semantic system comes to explicitly represent the implicit principles upon which procedural knowledge and episodic representation of that knowledge rest, And, of course, as the consequences of this second and third order representation alter the nature of procedure itself. Thus, the democratic political theorist, for example, can finally put into words the essence of religious myth after the myth had captured in image the essence of adaptive behavior, can talk about intrinsic right as if that notion were something rational. This process of increasing abstraction and representation is equivalent to development of higher consciousness, especially if the ever more enlightened words are, in fact, utopian wish, transformed back down the hierarchy to the level of action. The major advantage of increased abstraction of representation, apart from ease of communication, is increased adaptive flexibility. Alterations in abstract thought can proceed as if a game, without immediate practical consequences, positive or negative. The disadvantage of this adaptive flexibility is the emergence of ability to constantly, and inappropriately in most cases, undermine the a priori presumptions of the game, to call the rules into question, to dissolve impetus for action, and to disinhibit existential anxiety. A game is fun until the rules appear childish. Then the fun disappears. This might be progress in time. Until a new game appears, however, it is merely troublesome. The process of abstract semantic inquiry is capable of undermining moral adaptation at each level, semantic, episodic, and procedural, simultaneously. This possibility might be regarded, once again, as a destructive-slash-beneficial side effect of the ability to abstract. The evolutionary construction of an adaptive social structure, simultaneously extant in behavior and in semantic slash episodic representation of that behavior, means abstraction and hierarchical organization of knowledge hard won in the physical battle for survival, and consequent capacity for immediate communication of that knowledge in the absence of direct demonstration. Furthermore, it means potential for alteration and experimentation in the abstract, in play, episodic and semantic, prior to application in the real world. Acquisition of such ability, the capacity for abstract creative thought and social exchange thereof, means tremendous heightening of adaptive ability as concepts constructed purely semantically attain the capacity for alteration of episodic representation and procedure itself. Once the nature of morality is coded semantically, so that the implicit hierarchically structured presuppositions of behavior have been rendered explicit, they can be considered, debated, and altered in their essential nature. Such alteration is capable of resonating down the cognitive chain to procedure itself. Likewise, alterations in procedure are, and should be, capable of producing profound effects upon episodic and semantic representation. This increased flexibility, the result of a tremendously complex and lengthy historical development, is tremendously useful for the purposes of rapid adaptation and change, but also equally promotes conflict, social and intrapsychic. Such conflict emerges as a consequence of destabilization of historical tradition. It is the essential flexibility of the human brain, its very capacity to learn, and therefore to unlearn, that renders Homo sapiens so appallingly susceptible to group and intrapsychic conflict. An animal's behavioral pattern, its procedural knowledge, is set. Its way of being in the unknown cannot easily be altered in its fundament. The assumptions and values by which an individual human being lives can, by contrast, be threatened with a few well-chosen and revolutionary words, whose ease of communication belies their elaborately complex evolutionary history, the depth of heroic endeavor necessary to their formulation, and their extreme current potency. Sufficiently novel verbally transmitted information may disturb semantic, episodic, and procedural paradigm simultaneously, although the totality of such effects may not become manifest for years, not infrequently, for generations. Every culture maintains certain key beliefs that are centrally important to that culture, upon which all secondary beliefs are predicated. These key beliefs cannot be easily given up, because if they are, everything falls and the unknown once again rules. Western morality and behavior, for example, are predicated on the assumption that every individual is sacred. This belief was already extant in its nascent forms among the ancient Egyptians and provides the very cornerstone of Judeo-Christian civilization. Successful challenge to this